16. The Education of R.W. Howard, Director. Making movies became my second love after Cheryl. Actually, I was able to combine my two passions. She became part of my R.W. Howard repertory company, joining my long-term collaborators, Clint Howard and Rance Howard. Heeding Bob Totten's advice, I got the hell out of my backyard and pursued a more ambitious brand of filmmaking. I decided to up the stakes and enter the Kodak Teenage Filmmakers Contest, sponsored by the film company. Because of my Smith family commitments, I didn't have time to make a lengthy film. So I entered the contest's one-reeler category, which was a real test of discipline. Contestants were given an unexposed cartridge of Kodak Super 8 film that had 3 minutes and 24 seconds worth of footage on it. We were required to turn in our cartridges after filming, exposed but unprocessed. Kodak would do the developing and the evaluating. The biggest challenge is that this made no allowances for editing. The cartridge had to contain the whole film, shot in sequence. I concocted a Twilight Zone-like fable, in which a little boy in a modern-day outfit of ball cap, sweatshirt, and shorts, played by guess who, wanders into the dusty remnants of an old West town. Suddenly, his cap flies off his head. It's been shot off. A menacing outlaw from olden times, Dad, appears, challenging the boy to a gunfight. In the blink of an eye, the boy finds himself magically outfitted in a sheriff's uniform with a six-shooter at his hip. His courage is fortified by a beautiful young saloon gal standing off to the side, Cheryl, in a flowing period dress with her hair pinned up, who winks at him. The boy draws his gun and kills the outlaw with a single shot. Triumphant, he reaches to touch the face of the young woman, only for her to disappear into thin air. He casts a glance at the corpse of the outlaw, which transforms in a flash into a tumbleweed. A moment later, the boy's sheriff costume is gone, and he's back in his ball cap and tennis shoes. Was it all a dream? I called this film Deed of Daring Do, spelled D-A-R-I-N-G. I meant D-E-R-R-I-N-G, but I've never been a great speller. I didn't storyboard the film as I would now, but I plotted out 39 camera setups and made a shot list, timing out each one to make sure that I stayed within the cartridge's limit. One nice variable was that the credit sequence at the end could be as long or as short as I wanted it to be, which allowed me to fill out the cartridge to 3 minutes and 24 seconds on the dot. We shot it all in one day. I used my Smith family clout to sneak us all on to CBS's back lot on Radford Avenue in Studio City, which was where we filmed the show and only a 15-minute drive from our house. This back lot had once been the home of Republic Pictures, the low-budget studio that launched the careers of John Wayne, Gene Autry, and Roy Rogers. It still had an old West Street, complete with a post office and a saloon with those swinging shutter doors that was perfect for my purposes. 20 years later, it was reconfigured into a contemporary New York street for Seinfeld's exteriors. I reveled in recreating some Sergio Leone trademarks, such as framing a shot through the sheriff's straddled legs as he prepares to take on the other gunfighter. Dad pulled some excellent, hammy villain faces when I did the obligatory close-up of the bad guy's squinty eyes. I was also pleased with how well we pulled off the special effect of Clint's hat being shot off his head. It was entirely analog. We hooked a wire to his ball cap, and as he sat down on the edge of a water trough, Dad was lying flat on the ground behind the trough, out of sight, and simply yanked the wire to make the cap fly off. The tension mounted as we marched our way through the shot list. None of us wanted to be the one who ruined one of the last setups in my carefully programmed sequence, as a single screw-up would mean having to start all over again with a fresh film cartridge. But we had rehearsed so well that we nailed every shot and got the film done on the first pass. Clint, Cheryl, and I were relieved. Dad was the only one who wouldn't have minded a do-over. He was having the time of his life, playing the heel while making a movie with his boys on that famous Western backlot. About the only complication I encountered was an issue with the talent.
Hey, I immediately liked the concept Ron had for Deed of Daring Do when he pitched it to me. I liked the gunfight, and I liked that the film would be entered in a competition. But come on, I was the lead, and this was going to take up some of my valuable time. More than just a lark in our backyard. I was used to getting paid for this amount of work. We needed to have a talk. Kodak's Teenager Filmmakers Contest offered cash prizes to the top three finishers in each category, and I knew that Ron needed me, so I was in a great bargaining position. Acting as my own agent, I told Ron that if he wanted me in his film, it was going to take what we call in the industry gross points, say 50% of them. Otherwise, he was welcome to scout out Toluca Lake for another boy to play his lead. I was not about to endure another Wild Country-style negotiation disaster. My brother and I shook hands, and he gave me a call time to report for work. Shooting in continuity made the process more thrilling and suspenseful. As we got close to the finish line, there was real pressure not to screw up. It felt like a 2-minute drill with Ron as the quarterback. And guess what? Our little film cashed. Most of the other kids, intimidated by the time and editing constraints, did animated or claymation films. Deed of Daring Do was one of the few live-action entries. The judges sent Ron a certificate, lauding the film for its good storyline, effective use of camera angle, and very good cuts. That's a better review than the one he got in his hometown paper for Apollo 13. Personally, I was pissed that we came in second, but still, not bad given that there were thousands of entries. Best of all, though, second place meant serious prize money, $100. When Ron received the good news, he wasn't up in his room for more than 2 minutes before I bounded up the stairs and demanded, "Where's my $50? Honestly, I was giving him a break, because he also won a case of Kodak Super 8 cartridges, which I had no interest in splitting with him. Ron resisted my petition for payment. I was forced to call Dad in to mediate. Our testimony lasted only a few minutes before Dad ruled in my favor. Ron forked over the greenbacks. I went out and bought baseball cards while my brother went on to have a billion-dollar filmmaking career.
Clint's demand was ballsy, but a deal was a deal, and we split the money. It wasn't as important to me as finishing in the top three. This wasn't a local contest. The submissions had come in from all over the country. It was such a validation for me, a rocket boost, precisely when I needed it. R.W. Howard was determined not to let up. I used any excuse I could to make more films. For a school assignment about the Great Depression, I persuaded my history teacher to let me make a documentary rather than write a paper. This was my first talkie, albeit a primitive one. First, I recorded some audio interviews with adults who had lived through the Depression, Mom, Dad, Hoke Howell, Mr. Alley, and a few other people. Then I checked out some history books from the Burbank Public Library to scan them for good photos. I bought some diopter lenses, which allowed me to zoom in on faces and details, and then widen out to reveal further visual information in the photo. Basically, I was executing a crude, artless version of what later became known justifiably as the Ken Burns effect. Then for the presentation, I carefully synced the audio to the video using a projector and a tape player. My history teacher so liked the result that he had me show my film to all five of his classes that day. That was another huge lift for me. Next, I made a more proper narrative film, though the sound was still limited to voiceover audio. Once again, I concocted a movie to get out of doing a written assignment, this time for psychology class, where I would interview a subject about his or her life. I cooked up a completely phony story, let's call it what it was, a lie, that I told my teacher about an almost 100-year-old man at the senior home run by the Motion Picture and Television Fund. I explained he had been a real cowboy before getting into the movie industry during the silent era. What a subject for a school film. Thereby granted permission to go forth and begin filming, I borrowed a 16mm camera from the cinematographer on the Smith family. Working with his fancy Canon Scopic 16mm rig was a huge step up for me. It allowed for more tricks, such as dissolves from one scene to another, and a soundtrack, albeit sound added in post-production, not while I was filming. The film stock cost me a bundle, too, five times as much as 8mm. Being under 18, I still didn't have ready access to my childhood earnings, so I tightened my belt and spent less on date nights and gasoline. Fortunately, one $4 fill-up was all that my fuel-efficient V-dub needed to get me around Greater Burbank for a month. The non-existent nonagenarian was not to feature in my film, at least not on screen. I would dramatize a sad story he had told me about a beautiful young woman he had been forced to leave behind. The old man would appear on the audio track, singing a baleful version of the traditional cowboy song, I Ride an Old Paint, that he had customized to describe his plight. You'll remember that my dad had once dreamed of being a singing cowboy, but couldn't sing. Well, now he got his chance. His singing voice still wasn't up to professional standards, but my bespoke version of I Ride an Old Paint, sung by Rance Howard in a hushed, wheezy baritone, and accompanied by my pal Noel Salvatore's accordion, sounded credibly like the musical lament of an ancient guy at death's door. My dad had a good friend named Bob Jones, an actor turned assistant director who lived out in Agoura Hills and was willing to loan me his two horses. Another of Dad's friends, a character actor named Bill Conklin, agreed to appear in my movie, now called Old Paint, as the station master at my Old West depot. I scouted locations and found an abandoned train station in Piru, about an hour's drive northwest of us, that had the right look. In the film, the cowboy, played by Dad, is seen riding one of his horses while leading his second one on a rope. As the sad music plays, the cowboy rides through a series of rural landscapes. In an open field, he comes across a mother and son, Mom and Clint, with their heads bowed in front of a newly dug grave. The cowboy saddles up his second horse for the farmer's widow and the boy. He escorts them to the depot where they will catch a train and start a new life. He then returns to his lonesome wanderings. As night falls, he sits at his campfire and fishes out from his saddlebag a cameo locket with a silhouette of his lady love from long ago. There's a dissolve from the locket to an image of a beautiful young woman, Cheryl, crying as she waves goodbye to her man, me as the young cowboy, as he departs on horseback. Then we return to the campfire and the film's present day, where the cowboy broods over the flames as we hear him singing on the soundtrack, "Shoulda had more sense than to leave her so." Old Paint was no John Ford classic, but it did the job as a school assignment and furthered my education as a director. The staging and framing paid homage both to Ford and the muddy neo-westerns of Peter Fonda and Robert Altman, whose The Hired Hand and McCabe and Mrs. Miller had recently come out. I learned how to use natural light and make the best of my locations, which included not only Piru, but some wilderness areas near Thousand Oaks. I prepared shot lists, became more adept at camera placement, figured out how to use the editing room, and gave better direction to the actors. And for the first time, I presented human drama with something approaching authenticity, capturing bittersweet moments of love and grief.
Shooting on 16mm was a step up for Ron, but I had a couple of issues regarding committing to Old Paint. First, it was just a school project for him, and I was going to be giving up a weekend of prime wiffle ball action with my buddies to drive up to friggin' Lake Piru to work on it. Second, my role was small, and I was still required to whip up a bucket of graveside tears. I started to object, and that's when Mom got on my case. "You're gonna do it, Clint," she snapped. "You're gonna help your brother out." Dad was usually the family disciplinarian, but Mom had her own ways of appealing to the better angels of my nature. So I caved and followed my marching orders, giving the scene my full attention, sobbing like a baby when Ron called action. "Glycerin? We don't need no stinking glycerin." It was clear to me by then that Ron's zeal to make films was more than a teenage obsession. I never really had his drive to direct. I was in love with acting and recognized that directors could never sneak off to their dressing rooms for a nap. Then, as now, a nice perk of the trade. Acting was what I intended to keep doing as I grew up. That, or pursue my dream of becoming a big city sports writer. But Ron's passion for directing was obvious. So much so that it was causing Mom quite a bit of concern.
While Mom was supportive of my filmmaking projects, she didn't love that I was all in on directing. It was strange, a little like when I fell for Cheryl. "Are you sure you're ready to make such a big commitment at such a young age?" I didn't grasp how much this worried her until I bought my next camera. I was ready to move on from my Bauer Super 8 to a GAF and Schematic, a camera that offered an 8-to-1 zoom ratio and two camera speeds, which would enable me to film in slow motion just like Peckinpah and Penn in their signature films, The Wild Bunch and Bonnie and Clyde. I believed that this added versatility would allow me to experiment more and make better films. When I idly mentioned my plans to buy the GAF at the dinner table, Mom became upset. "You have a perfectly good camera," she said, with surprising vehemence. "Don't waste your money." Money was not the issue, though, and Mom knew this. I was making around $2,000 a week on the Smith family. I could easily afford the $179 purchase price of the GAF, which I did indeed buy. Mom was nervous that I was rocking the boat. I had already proven myself as an actor. Ironically, given the ups and downs that she had witnessed firsthand in my career and Dad's, she considered acting a safer bet, or at the very least, a known quantity. Acting was what the Howards did. Directing seemed like a risky thing to take on. But I was seriously considering giving up acting forever. Though the Smith family kept me gainfully employed, the slump that preceded it still stung, as did another humiliation. In the same period in which I auditioned for that show, my agent received a script for a TV movie entitled The Homecoming, A Christmas Story. Its author was one of Gentle Ben's former writers, Earl Hamner Jr., and the teleplay was based on his childhood memories of growing up as part of a large family in Virginia's mountain country during the Great Depression. Hamner's proxy, and the oldest of the family's children, was named John Boy Walton. John Boy seemed like a perfect fit for me. I had proven my country boy bona fides in the Andy Griffith Show. I had made a mini documentary about the Depression. I was just the right age. But I had not even been invited to read for the part. This did not deter me. It so happened that my audition for the Smith family was taking place in the same building where the Homecoming's auditions were, just down the hallway, in fact. I saw the name of the film's producer, Robert L. Jacks, on the door. I paced back and forth, thinking about the stories Dad had told me of knocking on casting directors' doors in New York, and of the life-changing moment when he walked in on the MGM casting session for The Journey, which led to my first acting role. I girded myself to make like Rance Howard and just go for it. I poked my head in, introduced myself to the receptionist, and said that I would like to talk to Mr. Jacks or Mr. Hamner about auditioning for the John Boy role. She seemed to recognize me, but her expression betrayed some discomfort at my request. She asked me to sit for a moment while she made a call. I recognize now that while doorstepping a casting director or a producer was commonplace in New York in the 1950s, it was highly unorthodox in Hollywood, where every meeting was coordinated through agents and managers. Spontaneous acts of self-promotion were frowned upon. Still, Mr. Jax graciously agreed to meet me right away. My guts were churning as I was led into his office, where a few people, including Earl Hamner, sat silently looking at me. I awkwardly explained that I was in the building for another audition, but had read and loved their script. And since I saw Mr. Jax's name on the door, I figured that I should introduce myself. I told them that my father had told me many stories of his life on a farm during the Depression, and that I was sure I could relate to the John Boy character and deliver for them. There was an ominous pause. Finally, Robert Jax spoke up, reminding me that he had produced the episode of Gunsmoke that I had guest starred in. He complimented me for the work I had done in it, which had impressed U.S. Marshal Matt Dillon himself, James Arness. With due modesty, I thanked Mr. Jax for his kind words, assuming that between this demonstration of familiarity and my long resume in prestigious network TV, I was on my way to being rewarded for my audacity and bagging the part. But there was another pause before Mr. Jax finished his response. He broke it by saying, "Listen, Ronnie, it's great to hear that you like the script and think it rings true, but we've been casting for a while and we think we know who we want in the John Boy role. But we'll certainly keep you in mind if something comes up and we have a change of heart." Unaccustomed as I was to rejection, I nevertheless recognized this brush-off for what it was. I said that I understood and thanked them for their time. With my heart pounding and a lump in my throat, I slunk out of the office and trudged back to my car in the off-lot parking to which I'd been relegated as a non-star. The John Boy role went to Richard Thomas, and The Homecoming became the basis for the series The Waltons, which ran for 9 seasons on CBS. Richard was absolutely deserving of the part and flourished in the show, becoming a TV star. By contrast, I was on the precipice of irrelevance. Being rejected stung, but it also motivated me. It reinforced my already burgeoning belief that what I really needed to do was get on the other side of the casting table as a director. By my junior year of high school, I had built up an impressive portfolio of student films that would act as a good calling card if I chose to seek admission to the University of Southern California. For the first time, USC was admitting rising freshmen to its School of Cinema. This was huge and fortuitous news for a film geek like me. USC's film school was the gold standard of undergraduate programs for aspiring filmmakers. Among its recent alumni was a rising young hotshot named George Lucas, whose name I had first seen in one of the books that Hank Fonda had given me, the film director as superstar. Francis Ford Coppola had mentioned Lucas to the author as someone to watch. So when I was a high school senior, I decided that my future lay on USC's campus in South Los Angeles and sent in my application. While I endured the agonizing wait to learn if I had gotten in, I began to envision the freewheeling life that Cheryl and I would enjoy after college. Cheryl wanted to see the world and study foreign cultures. Maybe we would move to Australia or Africa, and I'd work as a documentarian and photographer for National Geographic. Or maybe I would be a guerrilla independent filmmaker like John Cassavetes or Jan Troell, with Cheryl pitching in as sound person and editor, the two of us living as itinerant bohemians with no fixed address. Or maybe I could plunge into the artfully trashy world of grindhouse pictures and make something like The Thing with Two Heads, a recent sci-fi film starring Ray Milland and Rosie Grier that also served as a parable about racism. I kept spiral notebooks with lists of movie ideas, my febrile mind overrun with possibilities. I dreamed up schemes to finance independent movies, perhaps by going door to door and introducing myself. "Hi, I'm Ronnie Howard. You may remember me as Opie from The Andy Griffith Show. It's now my dream to make independent movies, and I'd like to ask you to support my goal by donating to my movie-making fund." I was dissuaded from pursuing this early version of crowdfunding when someone explained to me that I'd have to pay taxes on the money I collected. I sincerely toyed with an even more radical idea, one that I never dared share with Cheryl, though I wasn't entirely kidding about it. The year we graduated from high school, Gerard Damiano's pornographic movie, Deep Throat, became a sensation, earning $3 million in its first 6 months of release, a cinematic record at the time. A long game, Hail Mary notion developed in my head. What if I self-funded a serious independent film by doing another kind of film first, casting aside all shame and industry goodwill by making an X-rated movie? This SkinFlicks title? Opie Gets Laid. After a few days' consideration, I thought better of this scheme. Cheryl would never forgive me, nor probably would any moviegoer who paid money for a ticket and then saw me naked. One of the few things that kept me tethered to acting was the looming threat of boot camp and combat. I was opposed to the Vietnam War on philosophical grounds, in that it seemed pointless, needlessly destructive, and unwinnable. More immediately, given my status as someone who was going to turn 18 in the second semester of his senior year in high school, I didn't want to fight in it. Dad was equally vehement, notwithstanding his status as a military veteran. He still resented his 4-year stint in the Air Force for the time it took from him as a young man and the career opportunities that he had missed out on. He found the justifications for our country's involvements in Korea and Vietnam hazy, unlike the unequivocal call to action that World War II presented. He had no desire to see Clint or me in uniform unless we chose to volunteer. Distressingly for me, college deferments were abolished in September 1971. So even if USC accepted me, it wouldn't provide an out from the draft. Neither my parents nor I ever thought to consult a lawyer to see if there were loopholes or ways to game the system, as so many families of means did during that war. My parents were sophisticated hicks, but not Hollywood hustlers. They knew the ins and outs of show business, but didn't move in circles where special favors transpired. So I was on my own. Then it occurred to me, performers were known to receive special dispensation from the military. As a baseball fan, I had noticed that a lot of pro players, such as Nolan Ryan, Johnny Bench, and Pete Rose, circumvented the draft by joining the Army Reserves. You still had to report to an Army base periodically and serve your country in 2-week increments. You might be called upon by the league to travel overseas on a USO tour to cheer up the troops. But these scenarios sure beat wearing a helmet and fatigues in the jungle, one ambush or errant footstep away from sudden death. A regular acting job could put me in a similar position to these ballplayers. A network or a studio would have my back and figure out a way for me to perform some sort of service that didn't involve being a soldier. As an independent film director, on the other hand, I would be on my own. This may have been another factor in Mom's wanting me to stick to acting. I can't know for sure, since talk of the draft was taboo in our household. None of us wanted to openly contemplate the unthinkable scenario of me going off to war. But one day during my senior year of high school, the depth of Mom's concern revealed itself. We were having one of our set-tos about my slovenly ways. I had left my bed unmade, as per usual. Mom asked me, just for once, if I could pick up my room like a normal person. I responded petulantly that I didn't wanna. At this, she erupted. "You're gonna get drafted, and you'll go to Vietnam," she said. "And then the Army will finally teach you how to make your goddamn bed." She burst into tears and ran out of my room, slamming the door behind her. That was sobering. In my own self-absorption, I hadn't considered how much fear she was keeping inside. I never got much better at making my bed, but I did get better at being a son. I stopped laughing at Mom's expense and talking down to her. My teenage smartass phase ended right then and there. It was in this context that I took a part in a TV pilot that was provisionally titled New Family in Town. It was set in the Midwest in the 1950s, and its central character was a clean-cut teenage boy named Richie Cunningham. The pilot was written by Gary Marshall, a prolific comedy guy who had worked on The Dick Van Dyke Show and was currently with Love American Style, an of-its-time, hour-long anthology series on ABC that each week included three or four unrelated mini-episodes about love, sex, and grooviness. Tonally, New Family in Town was inspired by a movie called Summer of 42, a sleeper hit in 1971. Like that picture, our pilot was a coming-of-age story that looked to a more innocent past. But it was gentler and more G-rated than Summer of 42, or for that matter, Peter Bogdanovich's The Last Picture Show, another 71 hit about high school kids in pre-1960s America. Our show wasn't going anywhere explicit or raunchy. The most risque it got was when Richie's best friend, Potsy Weber, said that the newfangled invention known as a TV set was a surefire way to get action because you could invite girls over and, cringe alert, grab them right in the middle of Kukla, Fran, and Ollie. I played Richie. Potsy was played by Anson Williams, an energetic, upbeat guy from my high school's crosstown rival, Burbank High. Richie's parents were played by Harold Gould and Marion Ross. It was a good ensemble, and our show was being produced by Paramount Television. By my logic, if this show went to series, Gulf Western, the powerful conglomerate that owned Paramount, would find a way to keep the young star of its hot new sitcom out of the jungle. Gary Nelson directed the pilot. He was a relaxed and experienced pro who had directed me in an episode of The Andy Griffith Show and Clint in an episode of The Baileys of Balboa. The pilot story centered around the aforementioned TV set. Richie, at Potsy's urging, used it as a magnet to lure over the girl of his dreams for a date. I had a particularly good chemistry with Anson and Marion. As a matter of fact, Marion was the first person with whom I shared my good news. I got into USC's film school. I happened to be on the set when I opened the envelope, and my TV mom hugged me and wished me the best. ABC didn't bite, though. New Family in Town did not get a series order. Instead, the network dumped it onto Love American Style in truncated form as a one-off segment entitled Love and the Television Set. It has since been retitled Love and the Happy Days for the show's DVD release. So there went that potential safety net. I turned 18 on March 1st, 1972, and registered for the draft as required by law. I prepared to begin college at USC that September. I was convinced that I was done as an actor. Then my agent got a call. Universal was financing a low-budget period feature about California teenagers in the early 1960s. It had a weird title, American Graffiti. The film's writer-director had seen me on Love American Style and liked my look and performance. His name, when I heard it, rang a bell. He was the young hotshot out of USC that I had read and heard so much about, George Lucas.